Well, the wonderful thing about this class are all the people that are gifted to teach here. I mean, it was just so liberating for Kathy and me and our family to travel to San Diego and to Colorado to do church events there and just know that things are going so well here in this class. I'm not going to juggle, all right? But I thought that was so clever of Richard to do a little juggling thing because, hey, when you're studying the doctrine of the Trinity, it's a juggling act in a different sense. So, but I'm juggling other things, but I'm not going to do that. Okay. I'll give a little quick report on what happened in San Diego, Encinitas, and Denver. And then we'll get into the theme of Genesis chapter 7 and 8 and the animals on board the ark, the animals off the ark, the animals that were destroyed, and how we can use that to resolve a lot of conflict and controversy within the Christian community and outside the Christian community. For those of you that are guests, we're in the midst of kind of a Science in the Bible course. You know, I've taught a course at Simon Greenleaf University, which went on for, you know, 15 separate lectures, but there's a chance for us to get into all the content that I wasn't able to give in that seminar. And, yeah, feel free to ask questions. We do like to be interrupted. This is not so much a preaching situation as a teaching situation, which means we all participate and help one another. And, you know, I often build my next lesson and all the questions I get in the previous class. So I appreciate the comments you give. And in fact, last time I was here, a lot of people said, you know, why did God have Noah work for so long building the ark? What was going on there? Well, it's kind of a theme of one of the chapters in this book, The Genesis Question. So we'll be getting to that. Got a couple lessons prepared on that already. But what was going on in San Diego a couple weeks ago was that I was invited to participate in a design conference. It was a growing movement within the Christian community to really develop the design argument, the growing evidence for design that we see in the world of nature as an argument that God exists and as a tool for thwarting naturalism, the idea that there is no God, and everything we see in the world of nature can be explained without ever appealing to the supernatural. The laws of physics by themselves will explain everything, even the laws of physics we can get without God, according to the naturalists. And this conference was run by Christian philosophers, and they didn't tell me this when I arrived, but I discovered within the first few minutes of the all-day Saturday conference that really the theme of the conference was, let's just focus on design as an argument to knock down the naturalist paradigm. And what they really meant by that, let's take all the differences that we Christians have as apologists, put all those differences aside, let's not develop any messages that would expose those differences and focus on knocking down the common enemy of Darwinian evolution. And so this is kind of what I heard right off the bat, and you know, I was the one who was going to be responding to all the talks of the philosophers, and so I would have my chance to respond when the philosophers were done. But I just noticed there's a common theme from the philosophers there, that this is what we got to do. And the first one got up, J.P. Moreland, and said, you know, we can knock down Darwinism in 15 years if we Christians will simply put aside all of our differences and focus on this common enemy. And I'm kind of sitting there saying, now, wait a minute. You know, when I speak on secular university campuses, the leading atheist professors of evolution or biology have already abandoned Darwinian evolution, and they're on to chaos theory and other interpretations. So why spend 15 years knocking down a paradigm that's already being generally conceded by the so-called enemy camp? And the other thing is, I looked at how old I was and counted up 15 more years and said, you know, I'm a little more impatient than that. And, you know, these philosophers are about my age, too. I said, what are they thinking? 15 years is a long time. And but I think when I did get my chance to speak, I said, you know, the thing I've observed, speaking to secular scholars on this issue is our most potent evidences for a theistic interpretation of the world of nature, a Christian interpretation of the world of nature, is a number one, the evidence we have that there is a transcendent cause for the universe. There must exist some kind of being that brings the universe into existence, independent of matter, energy, space, and time. And the value of that is it establishes right off the bat, we have an undeniable miracle facing us. And there's a miracle here, we should at least be open to the possibilities of miracles elsewhere. And the second most potent piece of evidence is the fact that as we look at the characteristics of the universe, we see this incredible fine-tuning. And there you're looking at design where things are extremely simple. And what's wonderful about that, you're looking at these fine-tuned characteristics of the universe where regardless of theological perspective, the physicists and astronomers are saying we have overwhelming evidence for design. Why take 15 years? It's already happened in the context of the astrophysical sciences. And number three would be the origin of life. How we now have evidence that the origin of life takes place rapidly rather than slowly. That there are multiple origins of life on planet Earth, not just one. And I think the fourth most potent evidence and the newest one is the design that we're now able to see in these biological molecules that for the first time we're able to map down to the atomic level. But as I listened to these philosophers, what I realized is they're not using weapons 1, 2, and 3. They're hardly even aware of weapon number 4. They're all talking about transitional forms and Darwinism and why that doesn't work in a naturalist paradigm. Our strongest evidences are not being used. But I can understand why. If you use the strongest evidences, it's bound to expose the differences amongst Christian apologists. It's impossible not to offend the young earth creationists when you talk about the evidence for the origin of life. I mean, what's our proof that it happened quickly? The fact that life exists on planet Earth for the past 3.86 billion years. Well, if we're going to put aside the differences, we can't even bring up that piece of evidence. Nor can we bring up the evidence for the fine-tuning in the universe. I mean, every single evidence I see in the fine-tuning of the universe is an offense, not just to the atheists, it's an offense to the young earth creationists. So that weapon can't be used. Nor, of course, can you talk about the Big Bang and general relativity. Both of those are an offense. And so as I was sharing with the audience, this is that what I'm hearing amongst the philosophers here is an appeal to reasons to believe, to put down all of our armor, all of our weapons, and go into battle undefended. And I says, frankly, I'm not prepared to do that. Moreover, I think if we use our armor and weapons, we can get this done in months, not years. It doesn't have to take this long. And if we Christians are willing to dialogue publicly about our differences, that's going to communicate something very healthy to the secular community. That's how science advances. It advances through different models, different interpretations, being freely debated and dialogued in an atmosphere where there is no acrimony, where there is no threatened security. And what really made things helpful, there was a young earth creationist there, a philosopher, one of the speakers by the name of John Mark Reynolds. And in his talk, his main appeal is we need to put aside this idea that we're threatened by scholarship and research. We need to encourage the development of models. We need to encourage the development of different interpretations. And we need to test one another's ideas and models. And I went up to him afterwards and said, I've never met a young earth creationist like you. And he says, well, I think the only way we're going to reach secular society is by demonstrating that we have a faith that can be tested and that we're willing to test the faith and we're willing to make adjustments. And he told me, frankly, if this method of doing good science contradicts my young earth beliefs, then I'm prepared to let that go. And he also said, you know, I know nothing about astronomy. I know nothing about physics or cosmology. And so everything that you're talking about says that could well upset my apple cart, but I'm prepared for it to be upset. How refreshing to hear that. And again, I think how refreshing. His point was, if we can demonstrate that to secular society, we will gain their respect. But if all we do is come across with dogmatism, we're right, you're wrong, the Bible says so, that settles it, and we're not going to look at the evidence, we're not going to get anywhere. So, and we have a follow-up meeting with JP and John Mark about developing a better strategy to reach secular society, maybe leapfrog the Darwinism issue and get on to the things that are more important. So appreciate your prayers for that. What was wonderful is the next day I got to speak at Calvary Chapel of Encinitas. And that in itself is a miracle because we've been kind of blackballed from the Calvary Chapels, with one exception, that being the one down in, Kathy, you can help me on this, Capistrano. Yeah, there's a pastor there, in fact, the son of Chuck Smith, who has been very open to having us come in. What was wonderful about this church in Encinitas, one, they had a meeting with Chuck Smith Jr., and he was able to persuade them to open up our church to Reasons to Believe, because they're kind of sitting there in Encinitas trying to reach out to the professionals. And Chuck Smith was able to persuade them that, you know, Reasons to Believe could really help them in that arena, so they were very open. And what they had done as pastors and elders, they studied all of our books, and they said, this is definitely the way we want to go. We're changing our position on science and the Bible. We're going to abandon this young earth position and go for it. Now, there were a lot of people in the congregation that weren't quite with the leaders yet. But they nevertheless had me come in. And one of the things the senior pastor told me, he says, look, I was at this thing in San Diego. I want to give you the freedom to present the strongest design argument you possibly can. And you got to do it in 55 minutes. And I said, okay, that's all right. But he says, we're not going to put any restrictions on you at all. We want to hear the strongest evidences. Let the weakest ones go. We want to just hear highlights of the very strongest evidences. And the impact that had on the congregation and their guests was something that really pleased me very much. Because I saw a lot of young earth creationists there that invited non-Christian friends. And boy, I could just see the lights turning on, primarily in the young earth creationists, watching their secular friends respond. And, I kind of took the strategy, the theory of general relativity, and why we know with such great security that this theory is correct, the best tested principle in all of physics, thanks to discoveries in the past 12 months. And how that establishes that there must indeed exist a cause that creates a universe independent of matter, energy, and 10 space-time dimensions. And the fact that we can demonstrate this experimentally to beyond 14 places of the decimal, said, that's a miracle. That's a miracle really no one can deny. It's kind of like what happened in the book of Acts. Remember the Sanhedrin that gathered and they were talking about Peter and James and how there was this man that was healed in front of everybody, and they said, this is a miracle we cannot deny. Well, likewise, we're confronted with a miracle that people in the know cannot deny. Well, we have one miracle. We must at least be open to the possibility that maybe the naturalist way of looking at the world. I mean, what's giving naturalism its big thrust? And I saw this in an op-ed piece in Time magazine by Stephen Gould. His whole argument was, science deals with facts, and religion deals with ethics and morality, the way we should live, and the two never overlap. In other words, anybody who believes in religion is ignoring all the facts. Anyone who deals with science doesn't deal with myth. You know, religion is myth, science is fact, and the way he was insisting on dealing with science is that the only interpretations we're going to allow are those that are governed strictly by the laws of physics without supernatural intervention. So you can see the bias that comes in right away. But through the space-time theorem of general relativity, you can prove that that bias is incorrect. Then you can move on. Because I've noticed, I kind of shared with the congregation, if you launch out with design without doing that first, you're running up against that paradigm, that presupposition that says miracles never happen. Well, if miracles never happen, there cannot be any design evidence in the universe or in these biological molecules. But we can establish once and for all that here is one miracle that no one can deny. Then you can go into the design argument and say, here's all this fine-tuning. Is it natural? Is it supernatural? Yeah, Kathy. Self-designing principle, right. Well, you know, even that came up at this Encinitas meeting, because we talked about the difference between self-designed natural systems and systems that cannot possibly be self-designed. I mean, a good example would be stars forming or raindrops forming. There's a certain amount of design that's built into those systems. The formation of stars and raindrops definitely violates strict thermodynamic equilibrium. So there's a good example of natural design. But you know what? You get a small deviation from thermodynamic equilibrium. The probabilities of this happening by chance are relatively large. Then you compare that with a fine tuning we're measuring the universe, and you just see, well, gee, we got 100 zeros differing the natural design from this thing that we're claiming is supernatural design. And so that way you can kind of test. But it's good to bring that up. Anyway, that went real well, and question-answer time went on for a long time. Kathy and I and the boys were in Denver last Sunday, and there again we got into a church that just a few weeks ago was staunchly Young Earth, and now is open to having us come in. They had three services, kind of like this church, but 2,500 people showing up for those services. Well, they shared with me afterwards that they had never had that many come on a Sunday morning. They were really excited by all the non-Christian guests that people had brought. So they gave me 30 minutes to speak, and they said, we want you to talk about how you came to faith in Jesus Christ, and we want you to talk about why chromosomal mitochondrial DNA clocks and how they establish the creation of Adam and Eve in a time scale that's consistent with the Bible. And then we want you to talk about this new discovery on the cosmological constant and why that's such a fantastic new piece of evidence for design and universe. Get it in 30 minutes and we'll be happy. And by the way, not everyone in our congregation is an engineer or scientist. We want this really at a lay level. Get it down to about the 13-year-old level. So that was probably the most difficult assignment I'd ever been given in my life. But I had three cracks at it. By the third service, I think I got there, so that really helped. But lastly, I really goofed this morning. I really meant to bring the first box of the Spanish edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. It arrived Friday, so it's in our other car. We'll get it here next week, but our translator down in Argentina finally got a deal with a publisher down there and got all kinds of copies published, and we have 50 boxes of the books up here for all the Spanish readers here in the States. And hey, it's just in time because we're pulling together events in Bolivia and Peru for next year, and we're going to have this book. This guy is an incredible translator. And guess who is his co? Well, he doesn't so much translate, but he just checks in detail all the nitpicky translation points. Remember David Carter?
Yeah.
Well, he's back with his wife, Lynn, in Maryland. He's a physicist and fluent in Spanish because he worked for so many years in Santiago, Chile. But he says, Hugh, I've never seen such polished, beautiful Spanish translation work in my life. And he says, just a thrill to check Alessandro Field's translations. So as I've looked at the other translations we have, we've been told that our Spanish translations are really the best of all the languages the book has been translated into. So we'll get it here next week. Okay, with that, let's jump into our theme. And we've been talking about in the past weeks that one of the biggest issues dividing the Christian community on science and faith issues, and for that matter, probably the biggest issue causing non-Christians to distrust the Bible, is this whole idea, is the Genesis flood global? Does a literal reading of Genesis force a global interpretation of the flood? And kind of what we've been promoting is this idea that 20th century readers are getting it wrong. The text teaches that the flood is universal, and the problem is with our 20th century perspective, we equate universality with globality, and we draw the wrong conclusion that the text is teaching a global flood, when in fact what it's teaching is a universal flood. And so we spend some time just pointing out the difference between a flood that's universal and a flood that's global. Hey, if people are limited to the environs of Mesopotamia, all you got to do is flood the environs of Mesopotamia, and you've taken care of the entire human population. Everybody's included. And what we're going to talk about today are the animals. Because one of the challenges to this interpretation that it's universal but not global is, doesn't the text talk about all the animals being destroyed? So what we're going to do there is actually go through the text and look at all these animals that were destroyed and recognize that, again, it's not talking about a global flood, but rather the birds and mammals that are associated with human beings. All of them were wiped out except for those on board the ark. So it's consistent with the universal language we see in the text, but does not necessarily imply that the flood was global and put us into an impossible, contradictory situation with other texts in the Bible and, of course, with the scientific evidence. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. I'm not going to repeat it other than to make the point. As you go throughout the entire Bible, you will find many examples where it uses phrases like the entire face of the earth, the whole world, where the context makes it really clear it's much less than the actual whole surface of a planet Earth. It's simply the entire world of King Solomon, or the entire world of Joseph, or of the citizens of Rome, rather than the entire planet. Whose whole face of the earth? And isn't it wonderful that right in Genesis chapter 8, we see a distinction between the whole face of the earth for the dove that Noah releases compared to Noah himself. Noah saw the limitations of the water, the dove did not. Okay, number two, limited extent of sin. The principle we see throughout the entire Bible is that God's wrath never extends beyond the limits of human reprobation. When it came to Sodom and Gomorrah, God simply wiped out the cities of the plain. He did not deal with wicked people elsewhere because their wickedness had not yet reached its fullness. All right. If people had never settled Antarctica, there would be no sin residing in Antarctica, therefore no need to flood Antarctica, and certainly no need to kill off all the emperor penguins. And I don't think there are emperor penguins on board the ark. Number three, limited water supply. This is probably one of the strongest biblical arguments that the flood, if though universal, cannot possibly be global. The text itself tells us where the water came from and where it went. Genesis chapter 7, we're told the flood waters came from the rain clouds and the underground aquifers. The first eight verses of Genesis 8 tells us that after the flood, the water returned from whence it came. So it returned to those rain clouds and underground aquifers. And hey, if you want to work out a global flood scenario, you're looking at least 4.5 times the total water content of planet Earth, including not just the water in the oceans, but the water in the deep crustal portions of the Earth, as well as the atmosphere. The text tells us there's not that much water. Okay. Global flood proponents, namely the young Earth creationists, are well aware of that argument, and they say, well, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is mountains as high as they are today, but during the 40 days, they get eroded down to virtually sea level by very powerful erosion forces. Gets a lot of water falling from the sky, you get a lot of erosion. And so we have mountains 30,000 feet high being eroded down to, say, 500 or 1,000 feet. And then after the flood, we would have extreme plate tectonics, earthquake activity, and volcanism that would pop the mountains back up to where they were. Now, here you got a little more time. You got to erode them in 40 days, but you got a year to build them back up. But the problem is the Bible doesn't even give a hint of any of this earthquake or tectonic or erosion activity. Not a word in the flood chapters about these very powerful forces that are being invoked. Moreover, if there was this kind of tectonics or erosion or volcanism going on, it'd be impossible for the scientific community not to be aware of it, and that we'd be feeling the consequences of such extreme tectonics, volcanism, and erosion even to this day. Keep in mind that the people promoting a global flood interpretation also build into their theology that the continents split apart and drifted to their current positions during the 1 year of the flood. So what you're really looking at is plate tectonic activity amounting to 6,000 miles a year. Okay, well, some of us were around when there was a magnitude 6 earthquake here in Southern California. Hey, I've lived here for, 25 years now, and I've been through three of them. And the average ground movement in that case is 2 inches. And I would hate to multiply those 2 inches up to 6,000 miles. In fact, you would be able to determine the atmosphere is not going to survive. The ocean's not going to survive, let alone Noah and the ark. And so we have a problem right there. I saw a question over here. Yes, Wes.
Just a slight variation to that scenario. I've heard some local folks want to say, well, perhaps we're using high mountains.
Okay, Wes is bringing up the point, don't some global flood proponents postulate that there were no mountains until after the flood? That we haven't got the problem of eroding them all down in 40 days. You know, that's been thrown out by old Earth creationists. Frankly, I don't know of any young Earth creationists that are proposing that there were no mountains at all before the flood. And the reason why is if you look in Psalms and Proverbs, you see some strong statements there to the effect that the mountains have been around before human beings were here. It talks about the stability and the longevity of these mountains. And so recognizing those verses, especially in Psalms and Proverbs, young Earth creationists do not take that position. And as I've taught to them and said, why don't you take that position? Wouldn't it relieve some difficulty in your interpretation? They say, not significantly. Hey, we're talking about 6,000 feet of plate tectonics in 1 year. What's the big deal of eroding mountains down 30,000 feet in 40 days? And I say, well, you got a point there. I mean, it's just as absurd to argue for 6,000 feet of plate tectonics in 1 year as it is to erode mountains 30,000 feet. And by the way, I didn't use the word absurd, but in 40 days. But they do have a good argument that it doesn't really significantly weaken their position to eliminate the 40 days of erosion. But it is a possible interpretation. But it is going to run you into significant exegetical problems when you look at the Psalms and the Proverbs. Yeah, go ahead. What do I feel was the population of the earth at the time of the flood? I don't think it was very high. If it was very high, we'd have to explain why there's no archaeological evidence. I mean, there's zero archaeological evidence. There's zero fossil evidence for the human species previous to the flood. To explain the complete lack of evidence, the human population would have to be relatively low. And a point I make in this book is that we have murder totally out of control in the days before the flood. And we've discussed here in the class how one of the reasons God acted with such extreme measures against human reprobation, human wickedness, is that the human population was in danger of self-extermination. Murder was so wildly out of control that if God didn't act, there would be no human beings at all. And so in one sense, the flood judgment we see in Genesis is an act of mercy, an act of rescue. And the context for that is the first thing God talks to Noah about after the flood, Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, the first thing he addresses is murder. And he tells Noah, I will not tolerate this murder any longer. It must be restrained. And this is the first mention of the death penalty in the Bible. And what God is sharing with Noah, he says, look, this is such a serious issue for your species that I'm giving the authority to the government to take away the life of anyone that removes somebody else's life. Now, a lot of people have misinterpreted that and see that as something that must be done. Basically, what God, and this is brought up in the Levitical law, because there you see the death penalty brought up for other things. What God is sharing with the human species, these are things I do not want tolerated within your society. You must put a stop to them, but I'm going to set a limit to the penalty that you can put on the one who makes this offense. You can go up that high, if needed, to stop the spread of this social ill, but you can't go higher than that. In other words, if you can stop the expression of murder with less of a penalty, less of a retribution, that's within the biblical mandate. But if it's not stopped by those means, God is saying you can take it up as high as a death penalty. But one of the things he's pointing out, one life for the murderer. In other words, you can't do what some societies did outside of the Jewish nation, which was if you committed murder against your fellow man, the government would kill not only you, they would kill your wife and all your kids. What the Bible is saying is you can only kill the one who murdered. That's it. You don't have to, but if you need to do that to stop this from becoming a problem in society, do it. And basically God is saying, Noah, whatever it takes, up to the death penalty, do it, because I will not tolerate this any longer. And to explain the fact that we have no evidence at all, I mean, the amazing thing is this. People are living, have the potential to live 900 years, a little more than 900 years in the days before the flood. And we had a lot of classes on the scientific evidence for why we believe that indeed was the situation for the pre-flood peoples. Okay, if people are living that long and there is no murder, we should have billions of people on the face of the earth even before Adam is dead. I mean, even if you're very conservative about how many children each couple has, and I estimate the lowest you could possibly have without modern birth control methods is an average exceeding 150 children per couple. Hey, if every couple is having 150 children minimum, you get a very rapid multiplication of the human population. So rapid that the current population of 6 billion would have been attained in Adam's 700th year. So what kept it from getting to such a high level? Murder. And evidently murder was so widespread it actually kept the population small enough that we don't have any archaeological evidence. Now, how big would that be without having archaeological evidence? I would say in the neighborhood of a few million or less. So the population in the pre-flood era probably got no greater than just a few million individuals. Now, it may have been just in the hundreds of thousands, but it could go as high as a few million and still have no evidence. Yeah, Craig.
The idea that younger things are...
Global flood proponents.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, they're one and the same. I don't really see any.
It seems that they've kind of adopted secular science thinking of the tectonic with like Pangaea, one continent breaking up
and it seems sort of like bringing in sexual science to the back door of the post-flood evolution. Would a biblical, would it be a valid biblical argument against that position? Just that God hadn't already provided biblical land that territory to have moved out into the way.
This is an excellent point, Greg. I mean, you know, how strong does the Bible support the global flood proponents' idea that Pangaea split into seven different continents during the flood? The answer is zero. There is no biblical support for that position at all. Is there biblical support that God did it earlier? At least a hint. The Bible, in my opinion, puts it on the third creation day. Now, this is the one place in the Bible where it talks about God forming the continental land masses. Now, it doesn't give you a lot of details about how he did it or the history of those land masses, but it is the only verse in the Bible that addresses the subject. Oh, pardon me, not, that's too strong. There's a verse in Psalm 104 that speaks about that time during the creation day sequence when God made the great land masses. And how the waters cover the whole face of the earth, and then the land masses form. But clearly, the Bible places this previous to the creation of Adam and Eve, not during the flood. And so, yeah, it's an interesting irony that these global flood proponents have picked up on this modern idea of this Pangaea continent splitting into these different pieces. One thing I would commend them for, they are acknowledging that the scientific evidence for that is extremely strong. I mean, we can still see it going on today as we measure continental drift. And so I think they've kind of picked up on this. And see, what's really going on here is these individuals are presuming that all the geological features of planet Earth were formed during this one-year flood, this 13-month period that we call a Genesis flood. And so that means you've got to include all the continental formation, too. But the Bible puts it on the third creation day, not during the flood. Okay.
You're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands to perhaps a couple of million people all in the one valley that would have been flooded. How many people could that valley have
supported
without, you know, multiple-story dwellings?
Okay. Okay, good question. If you're claiming the population was as high as several million in the days just before the flood, is that scientifically feasible that that valley could support that many people? Well, an easy way to answer that is many more than that are living in that valley today. Okay, and that valley is not nearly as fertile or as well watered as it was in the days before the flood. And so in that sense, the valley pre-flood would have been able to support a much higher population. It has supported higher populations in the past, but even now, with a desertification of the huge portions of Mesopotamia, it's still supporting way more than that number of people.
Without multiple story structures.
Exactly. Well, if you read Genesis 11, it's got a multiple story structure in there. Okay?
yeah.
So, okay.
Once you have a flood,
you have a lot of water, or you don't want it. Yes.
There is a limited supply of water. I believe that the molecules that fall in our rainstorm today are molecules that existed in prehistoric dinosaurs.
That's true. I mean, that's...
There's only so much water. It's a limited supply. So that, for me, was that I never accepted a...
global flood. Right. That comes out of Genesis 7 and Genesis 8. The water content of the planet before the flood, during the flood, and after the flood, and today is identical. There's been no change, according to the scriptures, no significant change at least, in the total water content of planet Earth. What we have is God moving water from one place on the earth to another and sending it back to its original place. And you're right, there's a limited amount of water that you can...
recycle.
It's recycled water, right. I mean, people have argued, for example, every one of us in this room has within us molecules that were part of the body of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, this stuff just gets mixed up. And so it gets spread all around, and, you know, we're all drinking water from the flood even today. So when you go back there and have a cup of coffee, be aware that a few of those molecules participated in the Genesis flood. Okay. Yes.
It's interesting. I've looked in a book to find out what some of the greatest modern history floods were. And in China, in the Yangtze Valley, just before the turn of the century, they estimated that 900,000 people died in a flood there. The rains obviously were within 40 days.
Right.
The valley there is obviously a little bit steeper and narrower, but still the light total was about that.
Well, that's a very good analogy. That's one river valley where we had 900,000 deaths, not just casualties, but deaths. And I think that was what they, pretty close to the beginning of the century, where that happened.
1887, something around
right. So we got modern day examples where that many people were wiped out by a single flood that surely was not of the proportions of the Mesopotamian flood. Yes, Wes.
Question. I don't know if younger or older floods are very sensitive. So there's this massive plate tectonics and all the geological layers, you know, Grand Canyon over a mile, 5,000 feet laid down. How can the Sanctuary Grand River Valley still be identifiable?
That's a very good point, Wes. The global flood interpretation has within it seeds of self-destruction because they're invoking so much catastrophism during this flood that you're not going to be able to explain why this Mesopotamian valley existed before the flood and after the flood in virtually the same form. If you're talking 6,000 miles of plate tectonics in 12 months, that's very difficult to explain what we see here in the Bible.
No,
okay.
The mountains.
Yeah, the mountains and all that kind of stuff.
How would you know the original ones?
You know, why would Noah even be able to identify that he was near the mountains of Ararat if he had got that much catastrophism going on? In the back, then I want him to move on. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, she's encouraging us to get on with the animals, so we're going to do that. But let me just offer you a hint about why God took so long with Noah in building the ark and getting the animals on board. The hint I'm going to offer you is this. The answer is not in physics or biology. It's in theology. God had theological reasons for having Noah take 100 years. An argument I make again in this book is that given the position of Noah as a mighty prince in the land, he could have built that ark a lot faster. God has his reasons for slowing him down, and the reasons are theological. I'll just leave that with you. Well, I'll offer you this as a hint. God never judges reprobation without first sending a preacher and giving that preacher a pulpit. The primary purpose of the ark was to serve as a pulpit. And God says, look, I want you to preach for a long time. You know, so slow down on the building, okay? And as it tells us in Peter, that Noah was a preacher to his generation. And so there was a reason why God told him to build such a massive boat in a desert plain. It would get people's attention. So, and it did. Okay, let's move on. A fifth reason why the flood cannot be global, but nevertheless is universal, is we see the first nine chapters of Genesis so strongly condemning or dealing with humanity's failure to fill the earth. In other words, this idea that human beings were populated all over the seven continents is simply not true on textual basis alone. God gave a command to Adam to fill the earth, and from Genesis chapter 9, we can easily conclude that they had failed God's command to fill the earth. Genesis chapter 1 even gives us the reasons why the earth must be filled. God had given responsibility to human beings to manage all the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life, and makes a special point about botany. The green plants are to get special attention from human beings. In order for this to even be possible, humanity must occupy the whole planet. You can't even take inventory of those resources or the plants and animals unless you occupy the whole planet. And clearly, based on Genesis chapter 9, human beings have not done that. Wise had refused to obey God's command to fill the earth. They were resolutely disobeying God's command, remaining in one place in the middle of Mesopotamia, refusing to spread out and occupy the whole planet. And that's when God knocks down the Tower of Babel and performs a few miracles that we'll get to that ensures that human beings will be global in their occupation. Now, as a further support to that, notice that the first nine chapters of Genesis fail to mention any geographical place name outside of the environs of Mesopotamia. You get to Genesis 10, and now geography is global. So there is no global geography until the 10th chapter of Genesis. Previous to Genesis chapter 10, all the geography is within the environs of Mesopotamia. Therefore, you wouldn't need a global flood to take care of the human race, because the human race would not yet be global. Okay, the theme I wanted to get to today, in the minutes that remain, is how the Genesis text excludes the lower animals. You know, most English readers coming to the Genesis text make the mistake of thinking it's talking about all the animals on planet Earth, when in fact a careful reading of the text would draw you to the conclusion it's only addressing the higher animals. Moreover, it's only addressing those higher animals that have some kind of contact or relationship with human beings. Now, this is well supported by the teaching of the Levitical law, which makes the point that the only animals that can be negatively impacted by human sin would be birds and mammals that have had some kind of contact with human beings. So a penguin that has never seen a human being in its life will not be negatively impacted by human sin. And hey, we just got back not only from speaking in Colorado, but we got to spend a few days in Rocky Mountain National Park. And I took my brother-in-law with me, and I said, you know, Wade, once we get 7 miles from the trailhead, you're going to discover that the animals are different. And that's kind of a rule of thumb in mountaineering, that if you can hike more than 6 or 7 miles, you're into a place where human beings hardly ever get to. You know, the vast majority of tourists poop out in the first 2 or 3 miles. So if you walk far enough, you get into really pristine territory. He was just flabbergasted how beautiful that country is, but also how far he had to walk to get there. Okay? But it was true. We got to see. I mean, he was amazed that these ptarmigans would walk right up to his bootlaces. You know, these are birds that look like chickens that... anyways, I can see how many of you have been up in these. And likewise, these marmots. And we were sitting down and having a sandwich, and this bird tried to take a bite of our sandwich. I mean, it just comes right up to you. And this is kind of what we're going to get at here in Genesis 7, 8, 9, that animals who have never had contact with human beings behave or treat us differently than animals that do. You know, I've been up in the Canadian wilds where all the birds and mammals there, they come right up to you because they've never had this negative contact. Okay. In the time that remains here, let me give you just a little sample here of what's going on. Okay, let's start off in Genesis chapter 7, where, let me see if I got, I don't have that page, but let me see here. They were commanded, this is Genesis 6:16, Noah was to take a male and female of every living thing on board the ark. Now, every living thing to an English reader sounds like, well, that's probably mosquitoes and bacteria, little bugs, beetles, etc. Okay, you look up the Hebrew word that's translated every living thing. The word is basar. What's the lexical definition for basar? Birds and mammals. And it's more narrow than that. It's birds and mammals that have had contact with human beings. So the definition of the word basar does not refer to amphibians or reptiles or fish or insects or bacteria, just birds and mammals. It would not include the polar bears or the emperor penguins, because they would have had no contact with human beings, or those ptarmigans in Colorado, they'd be excluded as well. Okay, let's move on. Verse 19, the waters rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 15 cubits, more than 22 and a half feet. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Okay, let's see. What's the Hebrew word there? Again, is the word basar. Okay, well, what's wonderful about verse 21, and here's where you don't have to know any Hebrew. It says, every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Then it breaks it down for you. Birds, livestock, wild animals, and all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Okay, it kind of gives you some new Hebrew terminology for what this word basar really refers to. Okay, birds, that's the word auf. Livestock, bima. Wild animals, kai. All right, and then all mankind, that's the word adam. Then you move on. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Okay? Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. Now it's making a distinction between the creatures that are wiped out and the creatures that were saved. What is this everything living thing on the face of the earth that was wiped out? Yakum. Okay, notice in English, every living thing, two different Hebrew words. Okay, the point is this. If you want to nitpick the details of the botany and the zoology of the flood, you're probably going to have to read it in the original language. But you know the wonderful thing about living in the end of the 20th century? For a few bucks, you can buy this piece of software for your little notebook computer. And what it is the Bible in English in several different translations. And you've got the kind of program that we have. What you can do is click on any word, and it'll immediately pop up the Hebrew original word. It'll tell you all the other places in the Bible where that Hebrew word is used, so that you can go there if you want to do things. Just click on it, and it'll zip you right over there, and you can see the context there. And you click again, and it'll put up a lexical definition for the word, and it'll give you the reference where you can look up that lexical definition. Now, isn't it wonderful that we can do this at the end of the 20th century? Next week, you're all going to come with these notebook computers and programs, right? Just key it all in and figure it all out. So what I'm getting at here is you don't have to be a Hebrew scholar to play this game. For that matter, you don't have to own one of these computers or get the piece of software. You can buy a couple of books. And Reasons to Believe now distributes these books. And what it is that you can get a book which gives you the English translation, and underneath it you see the Hebrew words, and then there's numbers underneath those words, and those numbers will cue you to something like the theological word book of the Old Testament. And so what you do is say, I want to see what that word is in the Hebrew. You kind of write down the number, you go to your theological word book of the Old Testament, which, by the way, is written entirely in English. And what it does is it gives you all these numbers, and you say, oh, there's the Hebrew word yakum. Then it gives you a nice long lexical definition. More than that, the theological word book of the Old Testament will tell you how the definition of that word changed through the biblical centuries. So this is the way the word was treated, say, in the 1400s B.C., and how it came to be used in the days of King David. How it came to be used in Jews writing their commentaries in 1000 A.D., and how it's used today. And you say, well, the word shows up in Genesis chapter 7. That means in the context of circa 1400 to 1500 B.C., and this is how the word was used at that time. So that's kind of what we're doing for you. But, hey, you don't have to take my word for it. You can buy one book and a concordance. Get a concordance and this theological word book of the Old Testament, and you can do the same thing that we're doing here for you today. Well, you know what? I've run out of time, so what we're going to do next week is skip a lot of this introduction and realize, you know what was wonderful about this introduction? I've done it 3 times now, right? Yep. Every time I do it, we get a whole new different set of questions. What amazes me is that you people never ask the same questions. But the questions I got today did not repeat any of the questions that we had, and I did this review in the past. And by the way, that's why a number of you have been encouraging me. You know, Hugh, I know you could tell the audience, I'm going to skip the review, get the tape. Listen to the tape. But a lot of you have encouraged me, you know, these reviews, don't do it every week, but do it once in a while because they really like all the new questions that come out. So next week, we'll skip the review and then jump into this little word study. And hey, if you want to cheat, it's already given to you in this book, but we'll give you a little bit more than what's in the book. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that at the end of the 20th century, we can go to such an ancient document as the Genesis text and get answers to questions that are throwing our society into such turmoil on science and faith issues. Lord, that by itself is an amazing testimony to the supernatural inspiration of this text that was written 3,500 years ago. And Father, I pray that you would continue to give us rich insights as to what these first opening chapters of the Bible are communicating to us. Lord, equip us to such a depth that we can effectively use this information to reach and challenge people who have never been to church or have never given serious attention to the Bible or the idea that the Creator of the universe may have sacrificed himself on a cross in order that we can be delivered from our offenses against one another and against the Creator himself. Give us many opportunities, even in the course of these next few days. And Father, I pray that several of us will be able to encourage one another next week with the doors that you've opened to bring your light, love, and truth into the lives of people that are searching. In Jesus' name, amen.